I think at this point, I'm able to tell you that I have no financial interest to disclose. And my name is Claudia Fagan, and I am president of Physicians for a National Health Program, associate chief medical officer for the Cook County Health and Hospital System. But I'll be speaking with my PNHP hat on today. And the information that I present today is available also on our website at pnhp.org. I invite you to visit it. We have a lot of information, a lot of the articles that back the data. And I don't think I have to tell people at this setting that this is the state of U.S. public health care. This is actually old Cook County Hospital as they're taking it down piece by piece. It's kind of painful for some of us who've spent a lot of our careers there. We have a new beautiful hospital, but it's wholly inadequate for the population we serve. We run an occupancy of over 100% in the new hospital, which was built smaller because in the 90s when we planned it, we didn't anticipate that more and more people would become progressively uninsured. So we talk about the 46 million who are uninsured, but we talk about over 50 million, it's probably larger than that, people who are underinsured, and that being an economic definition saying that they have a health insurance, but a serious illness would cause them bankruptcy, as evidenced by the fact that half of all personal bankruptcies in this country today are due to illness or medical debt. And not to forget that the majority of the uninsured are working people and their children. And the, and increasingly, the people who are uninsured in this country are not those in poverty, as you see the divergence of the uninsured line from the poverty line. As the health insurance becomes increasingly expensive, as healthcare costs continue to rise in this country, more and more working folks are uninsured. Even 4% of physicians in this country are uninsured. And not to forget the data from the Institute of Medicine in 2002 that over a conservative estimate was that over 18,000 people a year die as a direct result of not having health insurance. Now, so we would look at, well, what is the state of American healthcare today? A third of us are uninsured or underinsured. We have health maintenance organizations that deny care to millions. Our death rates are higher than other wealthy countries. Our costs are twice that of other industrialized nations. There are executives who are making billions on healthcare. And we've witnessed the destruction of the doctor-patient relationship as increasingly people believe that there are health benefits to which they are entitled or would benefit from, and they have a provider or a physician or caregiver who is being compensated or rewarded to deny them access to that care. Ellen's already given you a summary of the McCain plan, but basically a continuation of the Bush agenda was accelerated privatization of Medicare and consumer-directed health care policies, tax credits, with no real plan to finance them. Many of you are familiar with Stephen Colbert. It's so simple. Most people who can't afford health insurance are too poor to owe taxes, but if you give them a deduction from the taxes they don't owe, they can use the money they're not getting back to buy the health care they can't afford. Unfortunately, and you know, I have to be a big fan of Obama, as I think many people are here. This is actually my neighbor as well. And you know, so their proposal is it's a Medicaid-like program that would actually be free for the poor with subsidies for low income, but still requiring buy-in from others and with employer mandates, and plans to regulate the insurance industry to eliminate things like cherry-picking and pre-existing illnesses. The insurance industry has demonstrated a very facile capacity to find ways to not provide coverage, to retroactively deny coverage. And I would venture to say that writing regulations tight enough to regulate the insurance industry might be more difficult than actually getting single payer. So I really don't question, I think you question whether there are cost controls. Really don't see cost controls in the Obama-Biden plan with the expanded coverage. And this projection that computers and care management and prevention are going to cut costs, I mean, these are wonderful things because they do improve quality of life, they do decrease hospitalizations, but there's not real good data to show that they reduce cost to the tune that will provide us the additional funds we need to provide coverage. So it's impeccable political logic or economic nonsense. But what I want to talk about for a little bit, because this is a big deal now, is you know people are talking about the Massachusetts plan and success of the Massachusetts plan. They did go from having some 700,000 people uninsured to about 350,000 uninsured, but at tremendous cost. I mean, the plan is well over $150 million over budget at this point, and the state as well as their providers are groaning under the burden of this. This was a plan that Mitt Romney used to launch his campaign, that they were going to do what no other bill had ever done. I would remind you that a previous governor of Massachusetts also launched a presidential campaign on the basis of a Massachusetts plan that was, again, going to do what no one had ever done and provide coverage for the uninsured. And what we see is, looking at the Dukakis bill and the Medicaid expansion, if you look at the number of people who have been insured under the Massachusetts plan, the overwhelming majority of people who were are insured under the Massachusetts plan are those people who are the deeply impoverished, less than 300% of the poverty rate, who got a free benefit, and that much fewer of the people who are in the 150 to, let me go to that, people who are in the 150 to 300% of poverty who have to pay a partial they get a partial premium subsidy, but they have a copay that is unaffordable to a number of people who have decided not to take that. And if you look at the people who are over 300% of poverty, that being someone who makes $31,000 if you're a single adult, the plans average about $390 a month premium with a $2,000 deductible. And so the people who are in this category, very few of them have actually been insured since the institution of the Massachusetts plan. And so you have to question whether this is really the way to go. They were successful by the massive expansion of Medicaid, which really looks at the need for, you know, the greatest success is with a public plan. And again, begs the question, why don't we go all the way with a single payer? But we'll continue that. Oregon also did this in 1992, was the most far-reaching healthcare reform in the nation. And they also didn't get very far in terms of changing the percent of uninsured in the state of Oregon. The state of Tennessee did it with 10Care in 1992. They were going to cover at least 95% of the uninsured by the end of 1994. And you can see their success has not been much better than the previous Massachusetts or Oregon. The state of Vermont, another governor who launched a presidential campaign. He did the only governor who's a doctor, signed a law today, put in motion plan to universal health care by 1995. And again, you see that we have not gone very far. And Washington State passed one of the most aggressive health care experiments in the nation. They were going to extend medical benefits to all 5.1 million residents of the state. You see, the New York Times does this a lot and says how wonderful they are. And again, I would remind you that they have not gotten very far or made much of an impact. The state of Minnesota in 1992-93, they were going to have a goal of providing universal coverage as well. And they as well have not fared very well. The state of Maine, many of you heard about the DiRiggio bill in 2003, and they become the first state in the union to approve a plan to provide universal access to affordable health care. And again, we have not moved very far along on the curve. So more than 16 months after the DiRiggio health program was rolled out, fewer than 10,000 people are enrolled, now providing coverage to about 5,000 of the previous who were not insured. So I go to the great philosopher Moms Mabley. Some of you may remember, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. And I would say that the plans that were being offered seem to be more of the same. And one of the problems with health reform is that we're not really talking about reform. We're talking about a continuation of what we've always done. And I should really attribute this to David and Steffi, David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler, founders of our organization, Physicians for National Health Program. It's unethical to prescribe placebo reform when an effective reform option is available. And I would say that that's what we've been getting a lot of. So here is a real, not a placebo, a real proposal, and that's the physician's proposal published in August 13th of 2003. I'd say JAMA has really stayed away from us since then. But we did sneak this one in. And the four basic tenets of the physician's proposal is that access to comprehensive health care is a human right. And it is the responsibility of society, through its government, to ensure this right. Two, that the right to choose and change one's position is fundamental to patient autonomy, and pursuit of corporate profit and personal fortune have no place in caregiving. And four, in a democracy, the public should set health policies and budgets, and personal medical decisions must be made by patients with their caregivers, not by corporate or government bureaucrats. And for me, that's get the hell out of my exam room. You know, that it's the right of the provider to talk to the patient about what their needs are and how best to meet those needs without being so adversely influenced by outside factors. So the response I get from a lot of people is, isn't that socialized medicine? And, you know, it confounds me in this country because, first of all, a lot of people don't seem to know the difference between socialism and communism. They kind of use them interchangeably. But that aside, what we're talking about, if you talk about the healthcare system and you split it and look at the funding and the delivery, a single payer is talking about taking public funding and paying for delivery, which could be public or private. What we do not pay for is private delivery for profit. And when I say for profit, maybe to make it clearer to most people, we're talking about investor-owned. We're talking about not paying dividends to someone who is not involved in the delivery of the care. So we're trying to make that distinction. And so, yes, I plead guilty. Yes, this is socialized funding. Much the same way we fund education in this country, much the way we fund police and fire protection. It's a decision that the health of the public is a public good and that we need to pay for it. And that we should do that in a way not to the beat of Wall Street, but for the needs of a population. And that we are all better for it when we do that. We would maintain that we could take the dollars that we spend on Medicare, Medicaid, the payroll tax, if it were to come up to 7%, and a 2% increase in income tax. And oh my God, she said the T word. You're going to raise taxes. But the reality is that doing this to fund a single payer national health program is actually cheaper for the majority of Americans than what they're currently doing in terms of out-of-pocket expenses, in terms of paying premiums, the fact that we cannot compete globally, that it costs more to pay for the health insurance of auto workers than the steel that goes in to build cars. And New York Times has called General Motors a social service agency that sells cars to fund its benefits. The reality is that, and we crunched the numbers on this, and here's a familiar number to you. If you make less than $250,000 a year, you pay less on health care under this plan. So what we're saying is that Americans want guaranteed access. They want freedom of choice. They want high quality, affordability. And here are two words you don't hear in association with health care in this country very much anymore, and that's trust and respect. So the reality is that we spend more in public dollars, and we have this slide updated, but more in public dollars than most countries in the world spend on healthcare at all. If we add in the private dollars, we have the opportunity not only to cover everyone in this country, but to do some really high quality things in terms of really looking at health and wellness instead of just being so oriented to the sickness model that we have bought into in this country. So, in a poll about would you prefer the current health insurance system or a universal coverage program like Medicare that is government-run and financed by taxpayer, the majority of Americans prefer a national health insurance. And then, if you twist it a little way, do you think that is more important, providing health coverage for all Americans, even if it means raising taxes, or holding down taxes, even if it means some Americans do not have health insurance coverage? And the majority of Americans think that providing health care for all Americans is more important. So there's the T word. So what would it look like? Everyone would have a health care card, that they were sure that there would be payment. There would be complete freedom of choice in terms of providers. I noticed that the McCain campaign talks about choice as well with this, and it's a little different what they're talking about, choice of programs. The doctors and hospitals could remain independent, nonprofit. They would negotiate their fees, and they would have global budgets. So we could have local planning boards to allocate expensive technology. Progressive taxes would go into a health care trust fund, which I showed you an illustration for earlier, and that the public agency would process and pay the bills. So this Walter Sue reminds me of this on a regular basis, that this is the civil rights struggle for the 21st century, that someday we will look back in the same way we ask ourselves about slavery and the denial of women's right to vote and ask, how could we have done that to 47 million Americans in the wealthiest, most powerful country in the world? So the message for Washington, Paul Krugman, who got the Nobel Prize a couple of weeks ago, said, the cost of health care is exploding, the number of uninsured is growing, and corporations that still provide employee coverage are groaning under the strain. So I would argue that good economics is also good politics. Reformers will do best with a straightforward single-payer plan which offers maximum savings, and unlike the Clinton plan, and we're talking about Bill, not Hillary, can be easily explained. We need to do this one right, so that health care is a human right. And H.R. 676 is on the table. And the only cure for a sick America is a single-payer national health insurance. Thank you.
Terrific, Claudia. Thank you very much. Before I introduce the next speaker, or as she's on her way up here, I just want to ask one of our friendly colleagues in the front row here to take this piece of paper so you all can sign in and we can keep track of you. Thank you very much. I want to introduce Susan Wood, who is has been active in first the Clinton and now the Obama campaigns, and a longtime activist and heroine to many of us in the world of women's health, to talk about her experiences on the campaign trail. So, Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ellen. When Ellen said we were going to have a panel on, you know, the impact of the elections, it's like, well, but it's before the elections. And it was also back in the spring when we didn't even know who the candidate was going to be in either party, or the vice presidential candidates. So it was sort of a shot in the dark in planning this session. But I wanted to talk about... not to some degree, sort of the different plans and what the elements are that are in them, but not go into. I think again, everyone's been hearing them at multiple panels and already here to hear some of the different ones, and just talk to us about a bit about sort of what are the common elements that we've seen. I won't talk about the politics of either necessarily how they came about or the politics that will happen in the after. Next week, in terms of trying to move something forward, but I'd also like to put it in, as I go through this, in talking about it from the point of view of women's health and why healthcare reform is important for women's health, and that's because of where I come from, and because I think having a lens of a women's health and a population whose healthcare needs are going to have to be addressed as well as part of all of this helps focus the mind a bit. As full disclosure, I am currently a co-chair of the Women's Health Policy Advisory Group for the Obama campaign. That does not mean I am a member of the Obama campaign and can control what happens. I know probably many of you in this room have some connection with the campaign as well and are doing bits and pieces, but did have the ability at least to send in ideas and hope that some of them stick. But I think it's important, that as disclosed, I don't have any financial conflicts of interest, but that's what I've been doing for the last several months. I think what we saw during the development of the different plans were a number of common elements among the Democratic plans. Not much happening on the Republican side until the McCain plan sort of gelled. But I think the Democratic plans had a number of common elements. They all built on the existing health insurance model. And expanding it, making it affordable, making it accessible to everyone, addressing issues such as pre-existing conditions, and getting everyone access to the current private health insurance system based on the employee employer-based system, not the in the group model, rather than the independent individual model. They all included something like an FEHBP plan, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, some sort of pooling of private plans from which one could select one of these affordable, high-quality plan insurance plans. They included a public plan, something like Medicare, and that one could enroll in. If one did not find one in the private pool, you could pick the public plan, in a sense offering people a chance to vote with their feet towards what would be a single-payer-like model, you know, leaving all the other options available as well. They all included regulating the insurance industry in order to get at the questions like pre-existing conditions and getting community rating and bringing down costs and so forth. And they all implied some form of financing that would subsidize or support or encourage or require, in some case, business and with subsidies for small businesses and low-income individuals to either provide plans as an employer or for individuals to be able to afford the plans that were being offered up. One of the key differences was whether or not there should be a mandate, and I think, you know, those who are, as we learn about what happens with mandates at a state level or think about it on a national level, that was one of the differences. The Obama plan has a mandate only for children to have health insurance, but also provides a requirement that insurance, the private insurance from which you are going to be covered as an adult, that you could keep your child on your family insurance plan up until the age of 25. And so I think those are just some of the things that we saw, I think that building on the experience of what happened in the 1990s, the issue of fear of change, you know, we're moving toward an election for change, but the fear of change in one's insurance status, which we saw with the Harry and Louise ads back in the 1990s, where we frightened the public that you're not necessarily going to get anything out of this. What you're going to do is you're going to lose your own health insurance plan, which people are clinging to. I think that seems likely played a real role in how this decision to stick with the system we have now and build on it and provide the options of models of single-payer plans with the public plan that provide incremental change but increase coverage and increase access. Now, in talking about how these plans, whether the Obama plan or the McCain plan, how they affect women's health, gets us look at what these plans really have for us. Women use the healthcare system more than men. They have higher rates of disability and chronic illness. They're more likely to rely on prescription drugs. And they also have some other health needs which are different in some cases, whether they're reproductive health needs or issues of long-term care or issues of increased rates of depression, anxiety, and so forth that need to be addressed in an appropriate fashion by the healthcare system. Women are also more likely to be uninsured or underinsured than men. Although they have greater access to public plans, they're more likely to be dependent upon their spouse's insurance that is employer-based. So in that sense, they're more vulnerable in the case of being widowed or divorced to being uninsured and are more likely to have poor insurance when they do have it. In particular, because women make up a larger portion of the, are more likely to be a part-time worker, and the types of coverage that part-time workers get is inadequate in all kinds of ways. When we look at the Obama plan and how it addresses some of these issues, it does, because it's trying to increase affordable health insurance for everyone, will move women forward as well as men by getting access to these plans, by getting access that is not, although you can get it through your employer, it's not employer dependent in that one can go through the National Health Insurance Exchange or to the public plan for insurance. It also has, in through regulating the insurance industry, being required to cover essential clinical preventive services with minimal or zero copays or deductibles. It will require coverage, which is distinct from particularly the individual market, things like maternity care, cancer screening and prevention, and treatment, preventive care, mental health services, reproductive health care, and other necessary services. And it also does have a focus on providing support for expansion of community-based prevention programs, including in workplaces, schools, and other federal initiatives that can partner with states and localities. So I think there is a recognition of the role of prevention and the public health infrastructure, as well as in just the clinical coverage, clinical insurance type coverage that would be made available. I think what this becomes important when you contrast with the McCain proposal, where it's hard to imagine, but it's a proposal that would actually make things worse. Because the McCain proposal providing a $2,500 insurance tax credit for an individual and a $5,000 tax credit for a family. Then adding, in order to provide the resources for that, to tax the employer-based insurance that individuals get, as taxable income for the first time, this would really shift the pressures towards moving people away from group employer-based coverage and into the individual market. And this is actually seen as a goal of the McCain proposal, that this would provide choice of individual plans, and that somehow all of these individuals flooding the market would be able to create market forces through competition to get a lower price and high quality plan. And I honestly don't see how an individual can go in there and negotiate a better price and coverage with an insurance company as opposed to, say, an employer with even a small number of employees can do better than someone on their own, and certainly not the larger employers. So it really puts millions of people and certainly millions of women at risk. And some of the issues that are specific to women is that the individual market in 41 states, it is 40 states and the District of Columbia, it is perfectly legal for that state, for that insurance company to set premiums based on whether you're male or female, and to charge women a higher premium cost than they can charge men. They can't do that in the group market, that's regulated, but they can do that in the individual market. And so just by being female and living in one of those 40 states or the district, you can, and it turns out many plans do, be charged a higher premium cost. Simply, even the same age, same risk rating, but just by being female. Another problem is that many plans and in many states in the individual market do not provide maternity coverage. Some you can purchase a rider, and a few, 12% actually cover maternity coverage, but many plans offer no maternity coverage, even while charging a higher premium, and don't even have necessarily riders available for you to purchase at extra cost on top of that. So this is what, when you're driven into the individual market, it really puts some very specific, creates some very specific problems above and beyond increasing essentially your taxes. If you have a group plan, you're now paying income tax on your health insurance benefit, and the tax credit that they provide you won't compensate for that, nor will it allow you to buy a plan in this individual market. in thinking about how these are going to move forward, I mean, I think we can't say what's going to happen. I mean, the polls will tell us one thing today, and if Senator Obama becomes President Obama, which I certainly hope he does, I think it's going to be all of us to figure out the strategies that can help move it forward, and whether or not having, you know, and people, you know, within APHA professionally, also within your lives back in the states and localities where you come from, but also in your amongst your family and friends that you spend time with, we have to really decide where it is we want to go and how do we place our energy. And whether having, for those who support a single-payer proposal, whether having a public sector plan is a strategy within the still maintaining the private sector system of insurance is one way to move towards that change if people vote with their feet and with their choices of insurance. And I think it will be very important to look at how, for example, if this type of model is something that is passed, what are the constraints and the nature of that public sector plan so that it's not just essentially doomed to fail, but rather is a plan that is designed to succeed. And we really want to make sure, and that's where the devil gets in the details, of how such a plan is so that it's not just the uninsurables are in that plan, and therefore it's a high-cost plan, but rather it is a plan that works, is affordable, reduces administrative costs, and therefore can pass on those savings to individuals and create a system that does help people move towards that if that's the direction we think it should be going. Regardless of how, you know, the plan that's put forward, and this is certainly stepping back from any role I've had with any of the campaigns, is we have to think about, how we actually change the public thinking about healthcare reform. I think we're at a moment now when people are focused on this, when they're not focused on the economy, and when they're not focused on the war, and I think we need to make the connections between all of these things in terms of the amount of money that's poured into both salvaging the economy and paying for this war, that we really, you know, have to go around and create the movement, as that's been talked about in several of the sessions I've been in, and certainly the movement from the women's community and the women's health community is one piece of this overall movement of pushing for healthcare reform. But it won't be this particular plan is not what will be signed into law. I think that's the one thing we can be certain about. Things will change. And we would like to change it by this would be a floor of what we get and not the ceiling. And so I think we have to go in and say this is the starting point and we want to make it better or get this. But certainly all the many details will change. Many things can be gained and many things can be lost as the process moves forward. And we have to both use our own expertise and knowledge and understanding of both the public health system, the health insurance system, and the health system writ large to help shape it in a way that's good, but at the same time, dialing back all of that expertise and talking to people where they live and the experiences that they're having so that we can, in fact, mobilize and get something actually accomplished after the election. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thanks very much. We'll have Q&A at the end of the presentations. I just want to take a minute and acknowledge some of our co-sponsors who've come in, Martha Livingston, the chair of the Socialist Caucus, and Nancy Krieger, the co-chair of Spirit of 1848, and if there's anybody else who's a co-chair of one of our sponsors, please let me know. All of our sponsoring sections and caucuses have been concerned, as all of us in public health have been, with the issue of the social determinants of health. And it's an issue, again, that's coming to the fore in the context of this debate over healthcare and the role that healthcare plays in creating health, and that the public policies that we want to advocate for will play in the next administration. Our next speaker is Larry Adelman, who's been the moving force behind Unnatural Causes, which many of you have seen. And Larry has we've asked Larry to talk about his work in bringing the messages about social determinants to the media and to the public in the context of the campaigns that we've been discussing. So Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. How do we get this on?